I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The Trump administration and the Republican leadership in Congress are still vowing to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. But as of now, Obamacare remains the law of the land, with growing numbers of Americans speaking out in support for all or part of Obama's signature legislation. What lies ahead? How healthy is the ACA, and what changes might be in store for the tens of millions of Americans who depend on it? Julie Rovner, the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Professor Brad Herring, a health policy expert at Johns Hopkins University, and Andrew Ratner of the Maryland Health Benefits Exchange join us today with some answers about the status and the future of the Affordable Care Act. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. We hope you had a nice Easter weekend if you celebrated Easter on this Easter Monday. And if you're finishing up your celebration of Passover, we wish you a blessed Passover season as well. Last week, before House Republicans left on their two-week spring break, they made another brief and unsuccessful effort to craft a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Their original bill to overhaul the nation's health care system collapsed on the House floor last month in a political debacle that revealed deep divisions within the party and embarrassed President Trump on his first major legislative outing. Afterward, as House Speaker Paul Ryan acknowledged that the ACA remains the law of the land for the foreseeable future, President Trump seemed to double down on his public contempt for Obamacare, telling reporters that the system is doomed. As he put it, it would soon implode. And just last week, the president threatened to hasten that process through executive orders. He warned that unless recalcitrant Democrats came forward to assist in the dismantling of Obamacare, he would withhold federal subsidies to health insurance providers that now enable them to provide medical coverage to low and income and disabled Americans. So even as the president and Republican leaders continue to rail against the Affordable Care Act, a poll released last week shows that public support for the health care law is surging, with 65% hoping that at least part of the Affordable Care Act is left intact in its current form. So how vulnerable is the Affordable Care Act to radical change, both from political and market forces? Is it really doomed to implode or explode? The president has used both verbs, of its own accord. And how secure are the health insurance policies of the tens of millions of Americans now enrolled under the Affordable Care Act? Well, our guest today will help us sort this all out. Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Before that, she spent 16 years as the health policy correspondent for NPR. She's also the author of the critically praised reference book, Healthcare Politics and Policy, A to Z, now in its third edition. And she joins us on the line from the newsroom of Kaiser Health News in Washington. Hi, Julie. Thanks for your time.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
And with me in the studio is Brad Herring. He's a health economist and an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. Brad Herring, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
Andrew Ratner joins us on the phone from his office in Baltimore. He's the director of marketing and strategic initiatives at the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange, the agency that runs the Maryland Health Connection, which is our state's health insurance marketplace. Andy, it's good to talk to you as well.
You too. Thanks, Tom.
You can join our conversation. 410-662-8780 is the number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Andy, let me start with you. How many folks here in Maryland have signed up to be part of the ACA?
So there were about 157,000 who enrolled this year in Maryland. That we thought that was well did well. We were off about 3% from a year ago. The federal exchange was down about 4%. But there were some internal numbers in that we thought were very promising. Maryland was fifth best in the nation in terms of young adult enrollments, age 18 to 34 as a share of total enrollments, up from ninth a year ago, and third best in terms of new enrollees. So I thought both those boded well for the future of the Maryland Exchange.
And to what do you attribute the fact that it went down instead of going up? I mean, some folks have pointed to the fact that as soon as the Trump administration took office, officials yanked advertising designed to encourage people to sign up. Do you think that played a part here in Maryland?
Well, it certainly didn't affect Maryland, where the state-based exchange handles advertising, but there were certainly a few challenges that we had to deal with. One was the rate increases that averaged about 26%. Now, that did not affect the large proportion of people who receive federal tax credits to lower their cost of insurance, because those rise along with the rate increases. But that had some effect. The exit of two insurance companies, United Healthcare at the big before the open enrollment started, and Evergreen Health, which was transitioning from a co-op to a for-profit carrier, at the 11th hour, had to pull out. So that left us with three carriers. That was a bit of a challenge, particularly in some areas where Evergreen was a strong option. And lastly, as you mentioned, the uncertainty. You know, it definitely affected some people. You know, we said if you were coveting the latest iPhone, but you heard that Apple was going to pull it at the end of the year, would you buy it? Would that affect your purchase? And it certainly did affect some people's decisions.
And Julie Robner, the experience here in Maryland, that's reflective of the experience that a lot of states are having at this juncture?
Yes, it is. And I think, the key word there is uncertainty, is that it for consumers are uncertain what's going to happen. Insurers are particularly uncertain what's going to happen. And frankly, you know, lawmakers are uncertain what's going to happen. We did see, you know, a slight downturn nationally. A little more than 12 million people signed up for calendar 2017. That was just slightly down from the year before, but it was below the expectations of the Obama administration. And, you know, how much that last minute pulling of ads contributed to it, we'll probably never really know.
And Brad Herring, in terms of the stability of the insurance market here in Maryland, I mean, what's your take on it as we stand here in April?
Yeah, so big picture, I would say things are pretty stable. I mean, I do think that the withdrawals of insurers here in Maryland and also across the country has led to some small premium increases as the level of competition goes down and the incumbent insurers feel that they can ratchet up their premiums a little bit. I think one big reason for a large premium increase from 2016 to 2017 was a set of federal subsidies that went to the insurers that actually sunsetted in 2016, leading to the plans to increase their premiums to offset that loss of a program. But yeah, moving forward, I think the plans do have a lot of uncertainty about what will happen within the Trump administration, what will happen in Congress. But big picture, I think there is, you know, relatively stable situation here with a, you know, small market covering people in this individual exchange.
And Andy Ratner, when folks inquire to your office about, you know, the future of the ACA and the future of the Maryland Health Connection, what are you telling them? What advice are you giving them? What predictions, if any, are you making?
No, we're not really making predictions, but it is still the law of the land. We expect the carriers who were in last year to return. We're hopeful for more, and you know, they should pay attention, and we will be out there again this fall with open enrollment.
So you say you're hopeful for more carriers. What's the incentive for a carrier to enter the market at this juncture, or at any juncture for that matter, given the fact that you have these big carriers like United Healthcare bailing out? What's your argument to have them enter the marketplace?
Well, there may be some more, you know, adjustments needed in some cases to make it strong. But in a sense, you know, this individual market, I think we have to remember, hardly existed before really more than a decades before the Affordable Care Act in Maryland. Over 10% of the population had no insurance. It was really persistent at about 14%. 10 people on the street, one of them didn't have insurance. Currently, 20 people on the street, one of them doesn't have insurance. It's closer to 5 or 6% now. So we're really, you know, building an individual market for a lot of people that did not exist before. So there will be some adjustments needed to get that right. But it's a big market for insurers.
Julie Robner, you know, as these, what's your take on the perception of the markets from the point of view of the insurance companies as their rates increase? that gives them some incentive to stay in the market, but also the subsidies rise as well. So it costs the U.S. taxpayer more as well. Where do you think that stands?
Yeah, you know, I think all other things being equal, most of the projections were that most insurers would probably stay in most places, and there would be some rate increase, not as dramatic as it was last year, because as we heard, that there were outside reasons for that, the expiration of some of these programs that gave the insurers sort of backstops. But I think, notwithstanding, right now you have insurers who literally don't know what to do. Their top agenda item, as you mentioned in the intro, is what are called these cost-sharing reductions. These are the subsidies to people with low incomes under 2.5 times the poverty line. And they are written into their contracts. They must provide basically help with cost-sharing, with deductibles and co-insurance and co-payment. This is separate from the premium help. And the federal government is in a lawsuit with the House of Representatives, and basically the Trump administration wouldn't even have to do anything other than drop the lawsuit to make these subsidies go away. That would, it's been estimated, require premium increases of 20% or more. Plus, a lot of companies, you know, have suggested they would be able to drop out of the market like right now, mid-year, if they were required to pay those subsidies, but the federal government wasn't going to reimburse them. So that's the biggest thing that I think the insurance industry is worried about when they're looking at, you know, what they're going to do going forward.
And Brad Herring, that sounds like a kind of a nuclear option, doesn't it? I mean, if all of a sudden the Trump administration does drop this lawsuit and these subsidies no longer go, or if the president makes good on his promise to drop them as a way of enticing Democrats to the table to tweak Obamacare in some form or fashion, that just blows up the market. Then what happens?
So that's a great question. I mean, I definitely agree with Julie that this cost sharing reduction issue is big and really in many respects like kind of poorly understood, because so many people have for so long focused on the tax credit subsidies that offset the premium. And as Julie noted, these cost-sharing reductions essentially convert what's referred to as a silver plan to have much lower deductibles and co-payments for low-income people. And if suddenly those cost-sharing reductions go away in terms of the money coming from the federal government, then the insurers are left holding the bag. And that would be catastrophic, might be overblown, but it would be really, really tough for them to recover in the short term. And then I think another thing that's looming is, you know, lots of discussion about what's going to happen with the individual mandate. And insurers are really concerned that if the individual mandate gets pulled through actions of Congress or maybe even through some administrative things that the Trump administration could do, that would leave insurers with a relatively smaller number of people enrolling and the ones who are enrolling disproportionately sick. Which would affect their bottom line in a big, big way.
Sure. Andy Ratner, I know we just have you for a minute or two. And again, we appreciate your taking the time. You're in the middle of a big meeting today. But the number of people in Maryland who joined the Medicaid rolls since the Affordable Care Act went into effect, what's that number been looking like? And what is the fate of those folks in particular were Medicaid to be cut back or reduced dramatically, which is at least at one point one of the proposals from the Republicans?
Right. The Medicaid expansion is part of it. In Maryland, the Medicaid expansion population is about 275,000 individuals. So added to the people who were enrolled in private insurance plans, about 400,000 individuals are covered, you know, through the Affordable Care Act in Maryland, and before it started, there were about 750,000 people estimated without insurance. So you can see it's made a big impact in terms of the population that was uninsured. And the biggest drops in the uninsured rate by percentage are largely in the rural counties in western Maryland, on the eastern shore. Also, other disparities, African-American population was almost twice as likely to not have insurance as the general population, Hispanic population almost three times as likely not to have insurance, and those gaps have been shrunk, you know, in the last few years. So in all those places, it's been very important. So what we're talking about is not theoretical. It's not just operational. It's a sea change in people having health coverage. So whether some adjustments have to be made to get this right, that's fine. But I think at the end of the day, if we go backwards in terms of the number of people without coverage, that would be tragic.
Andrew Ratner is the Director of Marketing and Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange. That's the agency that runs the Maryland Health Connection, which is the state's health insurance marketplace. Andy Ratner, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brad Herring is an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and former health policy correspondent for NPR. When we come back from a break, we'll have more on healthcare policy with Julie Rovner and Brad Herring. You are welcome to join our conversation here on Midday. 410-662-8780. That's our number. Our email, midday at wypr.org, and our Twitter handle if you want to drop us a tweet, at Midday Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stay with us.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation with the Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She's the author of Purple Hibiscus and Half of a Yellow Sun in the short story anthology The Thing Around Your Neck, along with the critically acclaimed Americana. Her latest book is called Dear Ajiwele, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. She joins me ahead of her appearance later this month at the City Lit Festival. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, that's tomorrow here in Studio A on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're discussing the health of the Affordable Care Act and whether and how and in what form the nation's health care system might change amid efforts by the Trump administration and the Republican leadership in Congress to dismantle it. My guests for the rest of the hour are Julie Rovner. She's the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and former NPR health policy reporter. She joins us on the line today from Washington. And with me here in the studio is Brad Herring. He's an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. You are welcome to join our conversation as well. 410-662-8780 is the number. Midday at WIPR.org is the email, and at Midday Tom Hall is our Twitter handle. So, Julie Rovner, one of the real central dilemmas in this whole business is the method in which we create a pool of people that includes healthy people as well as sick people that keep the costs down. What are the current ideas floating around out there about the best way to create the pool? The ACA essentially says we're going to mandate a pool by penalizing people who refuse to be part of it. What are some of the other alternatives that people are discussing?
I should point out that the individual mandate was originally a Republican idea. The Democrats had wanted to have an employer mandate. This is back in the 90s, to basically require every employer to provide insurance. And the Republicans thought that they didn't want to do that. So instead, they came up with the individual mandate. There are a lot of other ideas, you know, many of them surround, you know, making at some point you got to have a stick to go with the carrot. So you can make it harder for people to get insurance if they don't sign up right away. That's basically what Medicare does. Medicare says if you don't sign up for Part B when you're first eligible, then you will pay an increased premium indefinitely. So there, you can do it that way. You can have automatic enrollment. This is has been sort of pioneered with some retirement plans that people would automatically be enrolled in. If they didn't want to be enrolled, they would have to go to the trouble of disenrolling. That's a possibility. But, you know, basically there's only so many ways to make sure that healthy people get covered. And, you know, the theory is that everybody's going to be sick sooner or later, that not having health insurance is, you know, that these are basically free riders in the system until they need care. And the system just sort of can't support itself that way unless, you know, like, you know, it would be like only people who know they're going to have their houses catch fire would buy fire insurance. It just doesn't work.
And Brad Herring, Julie has written today in a post on Kaiser Health News explaining the impact of the IRS in this whole mm-hmm. scenario. The maximum fine is $2,676. So that's the national average cost of a bronze level insurance plan. And you can go bronze and silver, and I suppose, is there a gold too? I mean, can you?
Yep, gold and then even platinum.
Yeah, yep. And platinum, right? So. Most people don't pay that much. There are lots of folks who say that the disincentive is baked into that cake, given if you're a young, healthy person and the fine you're going to pay is more than you would pay for an insurance plan, then just pay the fine, take the hit. I mean, what about the idea of increasing the fine, you know, exorbitantly, really making it just impossible to ignore?
Yeah, well, I think you're hitting on the exact issue, right? So currently, some people are motivated by that relatively modest individual mandate penalty and are purchasing coverage when they perhaps might not otherwise. Whereas I think many people are still remaining uninsured because they view that tax penalty as not large enough to really get them to get coverage. And for them, you know, people with modest incomes. Paying the penalty, modest penalty, waiting it out for a year, hoping, you know, crossing their fingers that they don't get sick, relying on charity care for the year if something does happen, and then bouncing into the pool in a year if something does happen and they become relatively sicker. That can actually be like rational.
As an economist who studies yeah. would it be effective in really, dictating people's behavior if the fine was just really, really high?
Oh, sure. As an economist, I definitely think that if the mandate penalty was higher, you'd certainly see a lot more people gaining coverage. But I'd also expect you'd see a lot of pushback politically. From people upset that it's such a quote-unquote onerous penalty. It's attention all around. Yeah.
And Julie Robner, what about the idea that Speaker Ryan has put forward, at least casually, if not, and I guess it was part of the plan that he was proposing that didn't see the light of day, which is, don't worry so much about a pool that includes both sick people and healthy people, but create a separate pool for sick people and basically subsidize the care for those people. What sort of traction does that idea have these days?
Well, the problem with this, and they're called high-risk pools, and it is something that Paul Ryan's been talking about for quite a while. It was in the Republican plan that they put out last summer, their sort of talking point plan. It's been tried. 35 states had high-risk pools. By and large, they didn't work very well. It's, you know, when going back to what I was saying about only people who are going to have fires would buy fire insurance. Well, high-risk pools are basically places where sick people could go to get insurance. It was extremely expensive. The subsidies that were required to keep it going, sometimes from the state, sometimes from the insurance companies, were very high. As a result, there were long waiting lists for people to get in. Sometimes once people could get in, they didn't get coverage of the thing that made them get in. So if you got cancer and you could only get insurance from the high-risk pool, you might have to wait a year before your cancer got covered. That was kind of problematic. So they really didn't work very well. They would need an enormous amount of money to work very well. Instead, I think what's being discussed now, which might be a solution at some point, is what they're calling sort of the virtual high-risk pool or the invisible high-risk pool, where people would stay in the regular insurance pool, but there would be subsidies for the insurers on the back end to help offset the cost of some of those very sick people. Those were some of the very programs that just expired that started out in the Affordable Care Act. So now there's sort of bipartisan talk of bringing some idea of that back to help insurers and help people with pre-existing conditions. Interestingly, it's gaining some bipartisan consensus, but whether that you can graft that onto the Republican bill and still pass it seems unlikely.
Julie Robner of Kaiser Health News joins us on the line from the newsroom of Kaiser Health News in Washington. Brad Herring from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health joins me here in Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Lorenzo in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Brad Herring and Julie Robner.
Thank you. And I'd like to say I'm an early supporter of the ACA. Before it was called Obamacare, I actually was lucky enough to be on the front page of the Arizona Republic demonstrating for it maybe a year or so before it came into play. But as a supporter, I get really a lot of joy out of a statement made by one of Obama's advisors a few years ago. I can't remember which one said it, but he basically said that the Republicans named the ACA Obamacare, hoping that would be a negative connotation to the general public because they didn't like Obama's name, so to speak, and that they would rue the day that they did that because Americans would come to love it and would be associated with Obama forever. So I'm happy that they're having all this trouble trying to replace it right now. The second thing I have is a question, and my opinion probably is obvious, but I like to ask the professionals there. On a scale of 1 to 10 or in a percentage or whatever, how much responsibility do the Republicans, recalcitrants, and also the demagoguery, how much responsibility do they have for the position we find ourselves in right now as not being able to improve upon the plan?
And Julie Robner, I mean, that's a real question. The Republicans are basically saying that Obamacare is a disaster. It's going to implode. It's a terrible thing. But now, latest polling shows that 65% of the population thinks it's a pretty good thing.
Well, it is a real question, and certainly I don't think I want to quantify it, but Republicans have some responsibility for some of the problems of the Affordable Care Act. Certainly some things have not worked as anticipated, but generally what happens when Congress passes an enormous new social program like this is that Congress comes back the next year and the year after that and makes tweaks to it. And the Republicans who said they were simply not going to play, did not have anything to do with the passage, blocked all of what would have been ways to fix some of the problems with the ACA. They also blocked some of the money that we've been talking about for insurers who were basically under the law owed the money for treating people with high cost illnesses that they didn't get. The Republicans basically spent an enormous amount of time and effort talking the law down, and that I think at some point is coming back to bite them, because I think when you pull on the individual elements of the Affordable Care Act, with the very large exception of that individual mandate that requires people to pay a fine if they don't have health insurance, pretty much everything else is broadly popular. And I think what's happened to the Republicans is they kept talking about how bad the law was, and then when they got around to trying to actually fix it themselves, they discovered, lo and behold, some of those things that they were taking away were really popular.
Yeah, indeed. And Brad Herring, I mean, what is, given the political stance that the Republicans have now had for 7 years, repeal and replace, it's a disaster, it's going to implode, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, have they locked themselves into a political box that really makes it implausible for them, or certainly improbable, that they would be able to come and simply tweak it rather than wipe the whole thing out?
I think that's totally right. I guess I'd try to make three broad observations. Even though I'm an economist and love quantifying things, I'm probably not going to touch Lorenzo's request to quantify like the blame that you could pin on the Republicans. But one thing to highlight is the Republican governors and Republican state houses have really been important in terms of putting up roadblocks for the Medicaid expansion. So originally, as written, the ACA was going to expand coverage to everybody under the poverty line, and a Supreme Court case decision in 2012 essentially made that optional for states. And Republican-led states have taken a very partisan stance to not expand Medicaid programs. I think the second observation I'll make is that, yes, you can start to think about flaws in the Affordable Care Act that you could imagine in principle Republicans and Democrats coming together and working on bipartisan legislation to solve them. But the caustic environment we've had over the past 5, 10, maybe even 15 years just doesn't lend itself towards doing that. And perhaps gerrymandering and congressional districting is responsible for this kind of really skewed nature of the parties. So I think both parties are probably to blame for that. Moving forward, I think it's interesting that the Republicans have put forward ideas over the past 5 to 10 years about what their alternative would be, and yet Trump gets elected and they're still like still kind of waiting for the policy to emerge. And I think you could give them a little bit of slack in the sense that I don't think anybody really saw Trump actually getting elected. So when he finally did get elected, we're like, oh wow, like now they actually have the power to do something instead of pass opposition legislation. But another thing I think you could probably give Republicans a little bit of slack on is if you rewind 8 years after Obama got elected, there was about a year where the Democrats just couldn't pull it together, right? So you had far left Democrats who were, you know, in favor of a single payer, wanted a public option, and it took a while for them to get on board. And you had moderate Democrats who were opposed with reform efforts. And finally, they came together, but it really took a lot of effort. And in some respects, we're seeing the same thing now with moderate Republicans and the far-right Republicans, the Freedom Caucus folks, not being able to coalesce around a plan. And it's, in some sense, not clear like whether they ever will.
Yeah. We're talking healthcare here on Midday. That's Brad Herring. He's at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Julie Robner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, who joins us on the line from Washington. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Julie, do you think there is any political will or possibility at this juncture to, in fact, tweak Obamacare? Can the Republicans come to that to an agreement on that, given the rhetoric that they've employed and the how many was it 50 votes or something, 40 something votes over the past 7 years to repeal, and their promises to repeal it? Is there a political environment now that's changed, given the fact that they had this debacle last month in a bill that they did put forward or were going to put forward? Has the landscape changed at all?
Not very much. They're in a difficult box in terms of timing. The budget resolution that they used to do this health bill that would only need 50 votes in the Senate will expire as soon as they do the next budget resolution that will enable them to do tax reform. So they either have to finish health care or they have to do something about health care that would require 60 votes. The conservatives in the House, as we've seen, don't like the bill because it doesn't go far enough. The moderates in the House don't like the bill because it would go too far. There's a lot of concern. You know, what we haven't talked about very much is the enormous changes and cuts to the Medicaid program, which, you know, President Trump talks about, well, the Democrats will, you know, come and negotiate. Well, the Democrats are not going to negotiate an $800 billion cut to Medicaid. That's just not going to happen. That's one of the few things that's keeping some of the conservatives on. So figuring out how these pieces go together into something that everybody can agree on is not easy.
Julie Robner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Brad Herring's here with me in the studio. He's at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. If you'd like to join our conversation after we take a little break, our number 410-662-8780 and our email midday@wypr.org. Before we do take a break on Mondays, regardless of whatever topic we're tackling, it is our practice here on Midday to read the names of the people who have fallen victim to violence in our city during the previous week. We do so in sympathy with their families and friends. Our hearts ache for them. So far this year, 94 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, 9 people were the victims of homicide in our city. They are Maurice Walker, age 27. Douglas Holt, age 36, Tyrone McMillian, age 30, Darian Watson, age 27, Corey Earl Brown, age 40, Tyon Singletary, age 22, Shaquan Trusty, age 16, Victor Lane, age 50. And a Baltimore police officer, Troy Chesley, was killed in 2007. His son was killed last week. Trayvon Chesley was 22 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the status and future of the Affordable Care Act, known lovingly in some circles and scornfully in others as Obamacare. What changes might be in store for our health care system? President Trump and Republican leaders have vowed to dismantle it, and they do so amid growing public support for key elements of the law. My guests are Julie Rovner, the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and Brad Herring, a health economist and associate professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. If you want to get in on our conversation, you can send us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. And our phone number, 410-662-8780. So, Julie Rovner, we have a caller who's asked a question and then hung up, wonders how many people allow their insurance to lapse every year? Do we have data about that? In other words, these are people who have insurance at one point and then they simply stop maintaining it.
Well, there's two different groups of people, and it's kind of hard to tease out the numbers. There's what's called a lot of churn in the individual market. People are constantly going on and off, and a lot of these people aren't letting their insurance lapse. They're getting a job that offers insurance. They're losing a job, and now they may be eligible for Medicaid. They're going to go on Medicaid instead of their individual insurance. So there are a lot of reasons that people leave the individual insurance market other than the fact that they're just letting it lapse. That said, the insurance companies have been very concerned about people who sign up, pay a couple of months premiums, get a lot of care, and then stop paying and basically get their insurance canceled. And in fact, you know, what's been sort of little noticed in all of this is that the Trump administration did put out last week a regulation that's intended to stabilize the individual insurance industry. This is something the insurers wanted very much, that would cut down on people so-called gaming the system. Consumer advocates worry that it will make it too hard for people to get insurance. But insurers, you know, this was basically a requirement for them for staying in the program. So among the things it does is it makes open enrollment much shorter. It makes it much harder to sign up outside that open enrollment. And if you owed back premiums, then you have to pay them back. So that's one of the things that's intended to get at the problem of people, you know, using coverage and then if they think they won't need it, letting it lapse.
And Brad Herring, there are about 20 million people, I guess, who have insurance under the Affordable Care Act who did not heretofore have it. But there are still a number of people who are uninsured, right? I mean, this mm-hmm. we have not solved the problem of universal insurance one way or the other for Americans, have we not?
For sure, we have not solved that problem. I think if you start to think about, like, what are the reasons why people are failing to obtain coverage, I think one is something I mentioned in the earlier segment, which is you've got people who are in poverty, particularly adults in poverty, living in a state that just hasn't expanded their Medicaid program for political reasons. I think that's one big reason for people in or near poverty. I think for lower middle income, the problem of affordability still remains, right? So lots of people have gotten these tax credit subsidies and they're covering a decent fraction of the premium. That's got a lot of people covered, but there's still a lot of people who aren't covered because it's still leaving a significant amount of money for them to pay. I think the one thing that we've probably been most successful in terms of reducing the number of uninsured is, you know, prior to the Affordable Care Act, there was a small but still significant number of people with chronic health conditions who just couldn't obtain insurance in the individual market because due to medical underwriting. And that problem has been solved, for lack of a better word. Yeah.
Karen in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Julie Rovner and Brad Herring. Thanks for your call.
Hi. I'm going to not make any very eloquent or very new points about healthcare, except that next month will mark the 40th anniversary of my graduation from nursing school. And I've worked for 40 years, plus minus a little time, staying home for kids as a nurse at American hospitals. And the three home truths that I guess haven't changed but have evolved is with the progress of American healthcare. Thank God, 40 years ago, a lot of the patients I take care of wouldn't be alive. I take care of patients. I didn't take care of Governor Hogan because he was at a different hospital. But people like that would not have survived. And that's really, really expensive. But it's wonderful they survived, but it does cost a lot of money, and that's one of the reasons healthcare has become so expensive. The two home truths, I think they've changed a little bit, or maybe one that hasn't changed, is that people often think that they are invulnerable and that we don't all have to take care of each other. But the truth of the matter is I take care of many people in their 20s who were very healthy, and then they got a fever that wouldn't go away or swollen lymph nodes or this, that, or the other thing, and then all of a sudden they have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So we should never think that we're invulnerable because we're young or, you know, life is totally uncertain. But the third thing, and this is, I think, speaks to the crux of it, is that we're not like most of the world. We do have a social contract, whether it's spoken or unspoken, that everybody will get taken care of. And so to do that, we have to offset the costs of taking care of people who don't have. And we're a wonderful, wonderful country. So the mandate is really the only way to do it. And we keep coming back to that home truth. And the Republicans, after 7 years of blathering and blundering around and saying a lot of silly things, came hard up against that fact.
Well, thank you for your call. I appreciate it, Karen, and thank you for your service as a nurse. My mom was a nurse for many years. I got a soft spot in my heart for nurses, so thank you very much. Julie Robner, when it comes to Medicaid, you touched on this a few minutes ago. There are actually some conservatives, I guess, who think that expanding Medicaid was the best part of the ACA, and they are, in some quarters, proposing that we allow buy-in to Medicaid instead of creating exchanges. People think that Medicaid is a better solution than exchanges. What kind of traction is an idea like that getting on Capitol Hill these days?
Medicaid is very complicated. Medicaid, for people who don't know, is the national health insurance for people with low incomes, but it covers a lot of, you know, poor moms and kids, but the majority of the money actually goes to seniors and people with disabilities who often need institutional care. So it's got, you know, Medicaid is itself a diverse program. Right now, you've got a lot of the Republican governors from states that did expand Medicaid concerned about the Republican bill that would basically cut off the expansion and would also end for the first time the federal guarantee to match the state costs for Medicaid. That would be a very dramatic change, and that's one of the reasons that Democrats are so dead set against the Republican bill. You know, on the other hand, as you mentioned, you do have Republicans who think that, you know, perhaps people, particularly people with lower incomes, would be better off in Medicaid than they would in private insurance, and certainly in terms of what they have to pay out of pocket. That's true. And then you have places like Arkansas, which decided, you know, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of churn, particularly at people who are right at that Medicaid eligibility level between being in the private market and being in Medicaid. And basically what they did in Arkansas is they said, we're just going to buy everybody into private insurance, and so they don't have to go back and forth if their income changes. So there's a lot of, you know, sort of this love-hate relationship with Medicaid. It's the second largest budget item in almost every state's budget, including, you know, some of the big states like Florida and Texas that have not expanded. So, you know, the future of Medicaid is sort of built into this whole discussion about the future of the ACA.
And Brad Herring, President Trump has promised that his plan, whatever that is, would be better, cheaper, and everybody would be covered. He's made promises in many other arenas as well, and I think people believe those promises, you know, perhaps at their peril. I mean, given his track record when it comes to promising. One of the things that he talked a lot about on the campaign trail was portability of insurance, mm-hmm. Being allowed to purchase insurance across state lines. Who's opposed to that? Why are they opposed to that? And is there any data that says that were insurance plans portable across state jurisdictions that would help matters?
Yeah, so this is a real, real interesting issue. The notion of allowing purchasing across state lines is often how it's kind of termed, and often it's kind of couched in a very market-oriented approach of saying, look, if you look at most states, they're relatively concentrated by just a small number of insurers. And many people, particularly conservatives, would say if you increase that competition, you ought to get cheaper health insurance premiums. I'm certainly sympathetic to that view. But I think the primary objective behind people who advocate for cross-state purchasing is actually kind of a way of circumventing state benefit mandates for the types of healthcare services that get included and health care coverage. Conservatives have, I think, long been opposed to having benefit mandates, you know, including that treatment like, say, IVF or certain cancer screenings, like have to get included insurance coverage because they believe it ratchets up the premiums really, really high. And I think the real motive behind conservatives advocating for cross-state purchasing is essentially enabling people to purchase health insurance from states that have cheaper health insurance premiums because the coverage is not as comprehensive as whatever state they're currently in.
So, Julie Robner, when folks on Capitol Hill, whom you've been talking to for as long as you've been covering this beat, which is a long time, 20-something years, I guess. Yeah. That's because you started when you were 12, by the way.
Thank you.
You know, when people say, oh, we need to just tweak Obamacare, what are the two or three things that they think they need to address? And is there any bubbling consensus about how to do that?
Well, I think they know the things that aren't working very well and that aren't very popular in the Affordable Care Act. Things like premiums are going up too fast. It's very complicated. Signing up is complicated. Doing your tax reconciliation here at the end of the year is very complicated. Not enough competition, as we've been talking about. The problem with all of that is that, yes, there's only a couple of things that are not working well, but everything affects everything else. It's like pulling the thread out of a sweater. And that's what the Republicans are just discovering, that it really does kind of unravel things that you might not want to unravel if you're trying to fix something. It's, you know, the healthcare is very interconnected and extremely complicated. As the president is just finding out. And I think that's sort of the biggest problem here, and that to do things that are very popular, to wit, cover people with pre-existing conditions, you have to do things that are very unpopular, like require healthy people to have insurance. I mean, healthcare is all about trade-offs, and trade-offs are really hard for politicians of both parties. I mean, this was, you know, it was not easy getting this law passed, as someone talked about earlier. You know, and the fundamental, I think, problem, which we've only talked about a little bit, but that the nurse who called in mentioned, is that we can do more in healthcare now, and every time you can do more, it costs more money. Every time you make a test safer, more doctors will want to use it, and then you're spending more money. You know, sort of the underlying inflation in the healthcare industry is what's pushing all of this. And right now, the politicians are playing with who's going to pay rather than going after the fundamental of why are we paying so much in general for healthcare.
And in the end of the day, we do here in the United States have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. We are going to have to make that the last word. Brad Herring, thank you very much. And Julie Robner, much appreciated. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Sure.
Julie Robner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, a former health policy reporter at NPR, and the author of the best-selling reference book, Healthcare Politics and Policy A to Z. It's now in its third edition. She's joined us on the line from the newsroom of Kaiser Health News in Washington. Brad Herring is a health economist and an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We've got more information about the ACA on our website, wipr.org/midday. Sorry I couldn't get to Jackie and Lauren with your calls, but I appreciate everybody who did call and email and tweet. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with the award-winning novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She divides her time between the U.S. and her native Nigeria, and she'll spend the hour with me tomorrow right here in Studio A. I hope you can join us. Her books, by the way, include Purple Hibiscus, Half of a Yellow Sun, and Americana. She's the headlining author at this year's City Lit Festival, which takes place on April 29th. Thanks to The Diz for providing lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can catch them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. We appreciate it. Have a great day.